Welcome to the new season of Luxury for Good, the behind-the-scenes podcast for better social, environmental and cultural footprints in the fashion and luxury sector. We are in the garden of Gigi Hotel in Jaipur. You might hear the enchanting melodies of birds and animal calls. It is one of these moments where the expression suspended time takes all its meaning. Jaipur is the capital of the Indian state Rajasthan. It recalled the time when the region was governed by the royal family, who founded in 1727 the old town of today, also called the Pink City, because of the characteristic color of its buildings. At the center of its imposing network of streets stands the opulent city palace. Part of these complex colonnade buildings with gardens, country yards and museums remain a royal residence. It is the heart of the color gemstone jewelry expertise, with most of the cutters and polishers being based in Jaipur. On our quest for better footprints, we had the privilege to encounter Meet, one of the most prestigious providers of exceptional stone for high-end jewelry. He unveils for us the secret of his showroom, his passion for precious stones, and the city of Jaipur. Welcome to Meet and Luxury for Good.
L'industrie du luxe doit prendre conscience que les grandes marques de luxe ont des grandes responsabilités.
Pour un jean, il faut 7 à 11 000 litres d'eau.
Pour 3 grammes d'or, ce sont 1 500 litres d'eau gaspillées.
Il faut absolument trouver une solution.
Je ne vois qu'un remède, changement d'air immédiat.
Everyone that is interested and passionate knows that we have all the elements to change.
En tant qu'acteur majeur du luxe, c'est à nous d'ouvrir la voie.
Mais ce sont des méthodes modernes, il faudra vous y faire.
Welcome, Meet. I'm so happy to have you on this podcast. Please, Meet, could you present yourself?
Yes. Hi, this is Meet Badalia from Jaipur. I love my city because it belongs to a heritage, and gemstone is also a part of our heritage because they are in the earth and they came out from a long time, and this is why I love my city.
Could you tell us how you went into working in the jewelry sectors? It is a tradition within your family?
Yeah, it's a tradition in my family. My father started 30 years ago, and then I carried forward the business with him. And I really love doing the business of gemstones because it's an art, it's a luxury that you're providing to the customers.
You told me that you had to train yourself to take these positions. I think you've been studying gemology.
Yes, the practical knowledge I gained from my father, but for the book knowledge, I've been to GIA, California, and it's really important to know what's going on under the stone, inside the stone.
When you say it's really important to know what's going on under the stone, can you explain us what do you mean by that? A stone is a stone. No?
All the stones look same to a layman, but when you check inside with the help of a microscope or a loop, there are many things, a different world is going on inside the stone, so like inclusions, and according to that you can judge what kind of quality is it, from which country it belongs to, and is it heated, is it no heat, is it treated with somebody. So that's really important to know.
So you get the chance to get this knowledge about the stone. And did you train yourself as well about cutting and polishing?
Yes, and that's also a very important job, because if you have something and if you cut it in the right thing, then you get the value out of it. But if you cut it bad, so there's no value of the stone. So I got a chance to learn it from my father's friend, who is in this cutting business from a very long time. So when I started the business with my father, it was almost 6 months that I've been to my father's friend's office and learned how to cut the stone, from where to cut the stone.
So we're talking about stones, but maybe could you qualify which type of stone you work the most with? I think you're a specialist of precious stones, and that your workshop is well known for emerald, sapphires and ruby cuts.
We are specialized in rubies and sapphires. Sapphires from Sri Lanka, from Madagascar, from Burma, rubies from Burma and Mozambique. Because these two stones belong to the precious stone category, and these two stones are the most valuable stones in the world.
So how do you feel about keeping these precious stones within your offices? Is it a responsibility, a moral duty that you've got, that you owe to these stones?
It's a responsibility for sure, because keeping them safe, keeping them not breaking them or scratching them, and providing to the customers, we make sure that whatever goes, doesn't matter the amount, if it's small or big, but the customer should be really, really happy, because it's something that the customer feels wow. So we make sure to keep them very safe, and to ship them, to parcel them, we make sure that everything is very, very nicely packed up.
I was wondering, how do you define the value of a stone? Can you explain to our audiences that might not be experts in the jewelry sectors how you select the stones and how you appreciate their value?
So it all depends on many categories. So the first category is the size of the stone. The second would be the color. Third would be the clarity. And fourth would be the mines. And fifth could be the treatment on the stone. So if the stone is nice, it's big, it's clean, it's the best color of the stone. Depends, if it's a ruby, then it should be a very red. If it's sapphire, then it should be like a royal blue. But depends, because some countries like the lighter colors, some countries like the deeper colors. So we have to make sure that whatever best color can come out from the stone, it all depends on the cutting as well. So if you cut a bad stone, then the color will not be nice as it should be. So everything depends on all four, five categories. When you combine the categories, then you can decide the value of the stone.
So to get the best stone, how do you do? Do you get the stone from intermediaries? Do you go directly to the mine? How do you have access to these stones that in your boutiques are becoming true jewels being cut and polished?
So as I told you that my father is in this business from last 30 years, and because of his goodwill, people know him, people trust him. So people call him sometimes that we have something like this, or something is coming from this mine. So we fly to them, we check the rough, and if we like it, then we buy it, we bring it to Jaipur, then we cut and polish them. But it's really difficult because it's a very, very open market. So if you miss a chance, then you miss it, because somebody else will buy it.
So you have to be very reactive when you get information about something quite exceptional that is coming?
Yes, we have to be very active, and really thanks to the technology that we have WhatsApp, we have emails, we can access to the photographs. So it's really easy to do the Zoom meetings and video calls and check the rough on call. And if you are then interested, then we fly.
So at the rough stage, are you able to assess the quality at that time, or do you have to wait for the cutting to really unveil the quality of the stone?
So while seeing the rough, we can calculate what kind of quality will come out, but you never know, because sometimes what you see, it's not there. When you cut the stone, it changes, because it's really difficult to judge the color in the rough, because both the sapphire and ruby, they have color bands in it. So when you cut the color band, the color goes off. So it's really, really important to what you see, and you explain to the cutter that you have to cut it from here. So that it, then only you can get the best out of it.
Interesting. Do you go to the mines? Not that often. I think the market is more made of trusted intermediaries that, because of business relationship that have last for long, comes to you when they've got things that are of interest.
At back times, it was easy to go to the mines, but now, because Mozambique for the ruby is being acquired by the gem fields, so you cannot buy directly from the mines, you have to buy from the gem field auctions. From sapphires like Sri Lanka, Burma, you cannot go to the mines now because they have the control by the government, so you have to buy from the local market. But you have to have the right source, because there are every kind of people there. So somebody can cheat you, and there are nice people as well. So we have the old relations, they know us, we know them, so we buy from them.
And when you buy the stones, what informations are coming with the stone that you buy when they are at the rough level? So you were telling me you know roughly the carat, you know the country of origins, and sometimes you know the mine that they are coming from.
So when we see the rough, we can calculate the carat that of the final stone, because sometimes the rough can be of the same weight, too rough, but because of the shape of the rough, we have to calculate the final stone will be how many carats. And by seeing the rough, as I've told you that I've done the GIA, GG, graduate gemologist, so I can see inside the stone, and through the inclusions, I can judge that from which mine it's coming, which treatment has been done, if there is no treatment. So that is very important to check.
Interesting. And I was wondering, do you have any anecdotes about amazing stone that maybe came across your end at some point during your career?
Yes. From last 20 years, me and my father have been collecting some nice stones. And there are a couple of stories as well behind the stone, that sometimes we buy something, but we couldn't buy because we took the flight off the next day and somebody else buy it. Then after 1 year, we want to buy it back, but then the seller sell to somebody. And then after 3 years, we get to buy it, but in the double the price. So it's really interesting. It's a passion. You have to wait, watch, and have patience to buy whatever you want to buy.
And would you say that there is a tendency to have prices rising or pricing decreasing? Or what are the trends within the purchasing of stones?
It's obvious that the price will go up. It's going up. The graph is, if you see the graph, it's every day is going up, because it's a rare thing. It's coming from the earth. Nobody can manufacture it. So whatever is rare, whatever is getting less manufactured, the price always goes up. But at the same time, when the laboratories are starting making the lab-grown rubies, lab-grown diamonds, lab-grown sapphires, so the specific people who really want to invest in these things, they always buy the natural ones. And because of that, the price goes up. And it has been said that property, cars, jewelry, the jewelry is the best thing to pass on to the families.
Yeah, it goes through generation and generation. So
exactly.
It might have an impact at the time of extraction, but when it's there, it's never, most of the time you don't throw away your jewels. You keep it and you give it to the next generations. And
exactly. The jewelry is the best wealth of a family. So people really take care of the jewelry, because the value can never go less. It's really cashable, and it's a security of a family.
But I think there is a bit of scarcity in certain sources. Indian stones used to be very exceptional, but I've got the impressions that some of the mines that were around Jaipur, they are coming to the end of what they could offer to us.
Yes, there are many mines in the world, even in India, like Golconda, which was really famous for diamonds. It has been shut now. The Kashmir mines for sapphire has been shut now. But that's the best part, because the stones which are in the market, it's getting rotated from one family to another one, from one hand to another one. And at some point it goes to somebody's family, some locker. So it's really difficult, but it's good also, because when the things are getting less, the prices are going up.
So we were talking about the scarcity of natural precious stones, and how sometimes you can have exceptional stone in your hands. Could you tell us what is the, I don't know, biggest sapphire that you have ever had in terms of carats?
Yes, because it's limited. So sometimes we have something that we don't want to sell, but it's our business, so we sell it. But we miss the stones. And I would say the biggest sapphire, the finest sapphire I've ever had, is a 20 carat sapphire, loop clean, royal blue, octagon shape. And the ruby I had 8 carats, 9 carats, Mozambique. But it's funny, because whenever you buy it with the passion. But whenever you sell, you feel sad that it doesn't matter you earn the money or not, but the thing is going away from you, and you know that you can never see that such kind of thing again.
So maybe sometime you can see it on the creation of a high-end jewelry, and there is only you that knows that it's maybe your stones, and that's as well as celebrations to see a very precious stones becoming a very beautiful necklace or a very beautiful rings.
That's true, because when we sell, we never know that the final jewelry is going to which family or not, because we sell to the manufacturer of jewelry. But by coincidence, sometimes we see on Instagram that some big families of India, some big people, some celebrities from all over the world, they wear some ring or some necklace, and we can, because when we cut the stone, we know exactly what is it. So when we see the stone lying in some ring or some necklace or some earrings with some big family or celebrity, we really feel very happy.
So you're feeling privileged to be part of this creation of timeless pieces. If we talk about your offices, so you're based in the heart of Jaipur, where all the craftsman skills are. How many people do you have in your offices?
Yes, we are based in the heart of city, and even the street name is Jewelry Bazaar, which means the market of jewelers. And it's really important to be there, because all the craftsmen people, all the dealers are there. So you have to be a part of them. And I would say I have in my office 6 cutters and 7 staff who handles my parcel, who handles my accounts and everything.
So you've got 6 cutters, and maybe cutting and polishing is the heart of what you do. Is it hard to get the best? How do you train yourself to become one of the most gifted cutter?
We have to train ourselves as well. We have to train to the cutters as well. But it's never-ending training, because every day you find a new rough, and rough is very uneven. So we have to see under the lamp, and we have to see which should be the face of the stone, which should be the shape of the stone. And then we decide on a paper that this rough should be cut this way, so that we can get the best shape, the best carat, and the best color out of it. So it's every day we are learning many things. So it's never ending.
In terms of cuts, are there cuts that are more trendy for sapphires and rubies? What do you do the most?
So the most cut is ovals and pear shapes. But the rounds are very high in demand because of the diamonds, because diamonds are mostly rounds. So people have to match them according to the jewelry. But there are many specific cutters who some cutters just cut the rounds, the melees, which is really difficult, because you need to be very precise, very small size. Some cutters are really specialized in oval cuts or pear cuts. Some are really specialized in squares, princess cuts, like that. So we have to distribute the rough according to that. So firstly, we have to check which rough will be which cut. So then we separate it, then we distribute to the cutters, then they cut it according to that, and then they give us back.
Yeah, it's very interesting, because you told me the melee is really something that that is very precise. Well, it requires a lot of skill and gift to be done. Even if the stones are smaller, they are more value added, bringing back the cutting and polishing for this type of tiny stones.
Exactly, because the tiny stones, nobody wants to do it now, because the new generation of cutters, they don't want to do it, because it takes a lot of time, but they can't earn so much money. Of course, we are paying the same amount to every cutter, but the bigger stones, it's really easy to cut, so they don't feel hassle. But the smaller stones, it needs to be very precise, so the new generation doesn't want to make the smaller stones. But as you say, there's no value as well, because in the smaller stones you cannot earn much. The most value goes into cutting. But yes, we have to be a part of the jewelry industry, and we have to serve everything to the customers.
Yeah, and currently the melee is quite trendy as well. There are some new creations that are using a lot of melee, so I think that there are a strong demand for that type of product. How many stone per day a cutter will do in average? because there must be specificity according to the complexity of the stone?
So it also depends on which shape you are cutting. If you're cutting a bigger size ovals and spheres, it can be cut like 60-70 stones a day. For the smaller stones, like 30-40 stones, because it's really small. And sometimes if you have some really high-end ruby or sapphire, then we spend like the whole day cutting just one stone, because we have to check after every step of cutting.
And how do you check? Do you check just by looking, or do you use, eye tech to check with the cut and polishing?
Of course, we check by looking, but with the rare stones, the high-end stones, we need to check after every cut, the weight also, the how much weight is going in every cut. So because keeping the weight more makes the stone rarer. So it depends on which stone you're cutting. So you have to calculate many things.
Okay, passionating. I wish I could try to cut one. Do you think you can give me... I can have a try?
It's not easy, because you'll end up cutting your hands, your fingers. You have to do by hands. It's not machines.
Okay, so I've seen, because we've been visiting your workshop, that in average, people who are not really young, they had a lot of... They seem to have a lot of expertise. For them, it was like... As if it was easy to do it, but there was no female. Is it just a men business?
It is not just a men business, but for the part we are into of the jewelry industry is like cutting, polishing and trading of the stones. So mostly men are dealing in it, because we have to deal with, you know, the lower people, the staff, the craftsmen people. You have to go into the dirty areas of cities, you have to sit on the ground, it's really dirty job cutting a stone. You get your clothes get dirty, so female doesn't want to do that. But instead of that, mostly females are working into designing of the jewelry, designing of the brands, and so females are really good in that. So I would say every human being have their own part of thing. So,
and would you have a daughter? Would you teach her to become? Would you teach her the know-how to cut and polish?
Of course, I will teach her, because then she can guide to the people who are cutting for her. So, but she will never cut by herself. Because I don't want her to be in the part of that category. But yeah, of course, I'll teach her to guide them, and I can send her to a good college, to a gemology college, so that she can learn how to make jewelry, how to do designing of the jewelry. There are many courses now.
So interesting. I was wondering, what is the average salary of a cutter's? I guess it depends maybe on... how many years has been doing that, but what would it be?
So it also depends on different things, because some cutters charge by per day, some cutters charge by per carat. So depends on what quality and what kind of precising cut you need. So the salary depends, but average I would say would be, for the regular staff, would be something approximately $30 a day. And sometimes there are some people who are having their own workshop, so we do outsourcing with them, and they charge by per carat. That would be something approximately like $2-$3 per carat. So it all depends.
And is it considered, because when we live in Europe, we've got other benchmark, other referential that we compare to. So you being Indian and doing business in India, would you consider that it's salary that tend to be higher than other salary? Or
of course it should be higher, but I'm not the only one who can decide the salaries. It's about the market, how it runs. And yes, because of the economy, the salaries are getting increased day by day, but you cannot compare with Europe or with America, because the expenses are also more there. The expenses are less here. The life is not that expensive in Jaipur.
I wanted to know, what are your clients' key expectations? Do they ask you many questions about your business? Do they come to visit you sometime? What are the nature of the relationship?
So it's endless as well, because when you meet a new client who never bought some high-end jewelry but they want to buy, so they start comparing that the amount they're paying for some high-end stone at the same amount they can buy a Rolls Royce or Bentley or a nice house. But then we have to teach them that whatever else you buy, the value goes down. But if you buy a nice gemstone, a really valuable important stone, so you get the price increased, even the legacy you get. And when you wear it, the people who sees you wearing it appreciate you. And whenever you pass on to your family, to your son or to your daughter, they really appreciate and they really miss you. So we have to teach them a lot. And they have like very, very, most questions are like, why should we buy this mine? Why should we buy this mine? What kind of stone we should buy? What kind of shape we should buy? So we have to teach them according to their personality.
And sometime where you are subcontracted for high-end jewelry, do they have criteria such as I don't want any more stones from Burma, or I don't want any more stone for, I would say, any conflicted area? Is requests that are quite traditionally made to your company?
Yes, but it also depends on the country to country, because if you're dealing in Europe, they are restricted of buying anything from Burma. And then if you're dealing with some of other countries, some companies doesn't buy sapphire from Sri Lanka, some company doesn't buy sapphires from Madagascar, but somebody especially wants sapphire from Madagascar. So it all depends to the culture of the country. So yes, we are restricted of a couple of mines, but for different companies and different countries.
And in regards of rubies and sapphires, do you have any stones that are coming from Russia as well? Are mine in Russia quite famous? Or
no, so Russia mines is really famous for the emeralds, but we don't do. We do just ruby and sapphire.
Okay, and you were telling me before that one of the biggest marketplaces to purchase stone is in Thailand.
Thailand is a really good place to cut and polish stones, especially precious, ruby and sapphire. But Thailand doesn't manufacture, as in there's no mines of it. So it's all the roughs come from different mines to Thailand. We have an office in Thailand as well. We have cutters there as well. So it's a hub for rough.
Okay, so you can get the rough and then you decide, depending on the exception of the stone, where to cut it and where is the best for the stone to be pampered,
exactly,
polished,
exactly.
And turned into a beauty. Do the client come sometime to visit your offices or not that much?
Not that much, because we give the service that we travel to them. But sometimes they want to come to my office. They want to see many things, because whenever we travel with some limited stock. But when they come to my office, I can show them many things. And they want to compare, they want to bring up with their family, their friends, and then decide what they want. So yes, sometimes they come.
And from your point of view, how do you see the future of the business? Currently, India has almost the majority of cutting and polishing of the world, whether it's for diamonds and emerald, rubies or sapphires. Do you see that remaining traditions of India, or do you see maybe the business being more widespread across the world?
India is pretty famous for cutting and polishing, because the most important thing is the labor is cheaper here, and second thing is the skills. So the old people and some families where children are also into the cutting and polishing. So you cannot take the skills from them. It should be passed on by the generations. So I don't think the amount of cutting and polishing it's happening in India, it can happen anywhere else. Because if you say China also, now they started cutting and polishing, but they're doing with machines. So you can easily make a difference between two stones. One is cutted by hands, one is cutted by the machine. So people prefer the stones cutted by the hands.
Yeah, I think it's a very important traditions that we should preserve as an heritage. And because the jewels that are made, they go across time. There are good memories of things that remain the same at a time where the world is changing so much. Is there any message that you would like to convey or anything that you want to make come across this podcast in regard of jewelry and the job that you do?
I'm a very small guy to convey a message to people, but I would say, even I learned a message from a couple of big brands from last 10 years. If you see, the big brands was promoting diamonds 6-7 years ago, every big jewel of them having a big diamonds. But now if you see, every brand is focusing on the gemstones. So diamonds are supportive now, not the main stones. Because if you purchase a diamond 10 years ago, now it's still the value same. But if you have purchased a good gemstone 10 years back, now the value would be like 10 times. So gemstones are really, really important. But before, people used to think that we should invest in diamonds, only diamonds or gold. But it's wrong. You have to invest in color stones, especially precious stones.
And do you think that the value across the value chain is well shared? It's a tricky question.
It's very tricky because I cannot say it's pretty spreaded. It's not something that you can judge. But you have to trust the supplier. We have to trust our suppliers. And because we are in the market, so we compare and the prices goes like that. But for a customer, the value is whatever we are telling her. So yeah, it's all your own trust.
It's interesting because many clients, they don't really know what is the history of their stone. They don't really know that stone gets cut in India because this is where we have kept the best know-how. But with new technology, I think there will be more recognitions of craftsmanship specific to India because you can know, track and trace, and more clients are asking where the jewelries are coming from the mine to the cutter to the polisher and to the big brands. So me, I'm seeing the future of cutting and polishing being great because it will be less confidential and more recognized as a unique skill that that India is mastering.
In some way you can say yes, but you know, if I'm selling something to someone, I will never disclose from where the stone is coming. So it seems the jeweler who is buying a stone from me and setting it into a jewelry and selling to a client, they will never disclose the stone is coming from me or from India or from somebody. But yes, now we are into this business, so we can see the stone and the cutting style, so we can judge the stone is cut in India or in Thailand or somewhere else. So we have to judge by the cutting because every culture have, you know, it's cut by hand, so you can see the facets, how the facets are there, so you can judge where it cut. But it's really difficult for a common man to judge the stone that it belongs to which country in terms of cutting.
And do you think the fact that supply chain remains secret for security reasons as well, it's something that shall remain as a tradition within the luxury sectors?
Yes, it should. There should be a curtain between all the supply chains so that you can keep secure. Even the cutters, they need to be secured that whatever they are cutting, they should not know that for what price I'm selling. What price I'm selling, the jeweler makes sure that the customer doesn't know that what price they buy and from where they buy, because it's a very small thing. And nowadays the technology, everybody is there on internet, so if you get to know, then you can pass on directly to the first man to the last man and the market will be screwed. So yes, there should be little curtains.
Okay, interesting. Any other things that you want to share, your passion for vintage car?
That's again, it's like a luxury.
Yeah, so, because it takes values across time and it's not a disposable item, and that makes the business sustainable in itself.
Exactly. I'm a collector of vintage cars because I love the things which cannot be manufactured anymore. So like the gemstones, you cannot manufacture them. The earth is giving us and we are taking it and manufacturing it. But if I want like 10 stones of same thing, same quality, it's next to impossible. It's just a dream. It's same with the vintage cars. You cannot manufacture anymore. Whatever cars have been manufactured at back times. So we can buy them, keep them safe. So yeah, it's kind of like same thing only.
Thank you so much, Meet. Thank you so much as well for giving us the taste of India, for having us made a fall in love with Jaipur. This is just such an amazing city. We're feeling so privileged.
Same here. It's lovely to meet both of you, and it's lovely to give my thoughts, my opinion on whatever you asked. I hope people get some good message out of it and they love your podcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
How fascinating. Encountering with Meet was so instructive in understanding why the jewelry sectors maintains a culture of discretions and why it is so difficult to get the traceability. It is not only iJewelry brands wanting to preserve their sources to have access to the most precious stones, it is also cutter and polisher, not always willing to give full transparency as well. We could deduce that the price difference between the selling of the cutted stone and the acquisition of the rough exceed the cost of the mancraft. Margins have always been existing. Stone cutters assume a financial risk and they have to be rewarded for that. Most, if not all, the cutter and polisher met in Jaipur don't even work directly with the high-end jewelry brands. Most of the time, they sell to intermediaries that we call sometimes lapidaire or stole dealers that take margin as well on the cost of the stone. So in regard of traceability, one thing that was interesting to notice is that at the stage of cutting and polishing, we might have all the informations about the origin of the stones. In regard of decent living condition of the cutter and polisher, if you stay with your European expectations and standard, you might be shocked, especially in the colored gemstone sectors. Most of the time, cutters and polishers are sitting on the floor. They don't have any health and safety equipments. The job is demanding. It is art. The smallest the stones are, the toughest the job is. But they have been trained and they've got skill to cut and polish. And they depend on this income. They are paid according to their productions, with a minimum Indian wage being respect. Saying that, bear in mind that minimum wage seems to be about 9,050 rupees per month, meaning about 100 to 150 euros per month. Living in a capitalist world, it is still the owner who makes the biggest margin. The change might come from new Indian generations that are getting no longer attracted by art physical work and the brand as well, that want transparency and that want to make sure that working conditions all across the supply chains are decent. We will continue those discussions next time, talking about the diamond sectors. I can't wait to exchange with you. Thank you for your listening time. If you like this episode, let us know on social network. Give us stars. If you want to expand your knowledge on sustainability in fashion and luxury, or improve the footprints of your brands, rendez-vous on Etiwork website, LinkedIn or Instagram. À bientôt!